Almost exactly 1 year ago, 17-year-old Zachary Cruz was playing like on any other regular day. He was hanging out at the skate park when his mom's friend showed up suddenly and ran towards him in a panic. "Do you know what happened?" she screamed out. And it was in that moment that Zach learned that his older brother, Nick, had just opened fire on Parkland High School. In that moment, 17-year-old Zach learned that his brother had killed 14 students and 3 staff members. And in that moment, Zach learned that his brother had also survived and was in police custody. Zach and Nick's life had not been simple or easy up until that point, even beyond their father's death when they were little or their mother's death just in 2017. Nick had struggled. Nick had struggled with anger and violence, bullying, isolation, and loneliness. But still, Nick was Zach's brother. And after their parents died, he was all Zach had. "I'm stuck," he told the Washington Post. "I'm stuck between loving him and hating him." After he had a chance to meet with the detective, this person who was in charge of making sense of the senseless, Zach asked if he could see his brother. And the video of their meeting is gut-wrenching. Zach tells his brother when he sees him, "You probably felt like you had nobody. But I care about you. I know I made it seem like I hated you, but actually I love you with all my heart. I know what you did today. Other people will look at me now like I'm crazy even, and I don't care what people think. You're my brother. I love you." And after hearing all that, Nick starts shaking and crying, and Zach wraps his arms around him, stuck between loving and hating him. I know most of us will luckily not have to find ourselves in a situation where we have to figure out how or if to keep loving someone who has committed such a horrendous act. But still, we all know a version of what Zach is wrestling with in that room. If we have loved anyone at all, we know what it means to have to come to terms with their accidental or on purpose failing. To face their betrayal, negligence, cowardice, or lies. To try to understand why they did what they did, what part we might have played in it all. In the interview with the detective, Zach tries to play out how he might have prevented this if he could have been a better brother to him. We all know what it's like, in one way or another, to have to decide whether or not this thing that someone we love has done might have made them once and for all unlovable. Or if instead there is a path still to healing or restoration, to loving them anyway. And if so, what such a path might look like. It is a complicated question, and even more so for us as Unitarian Universalists. After all, one of our core historical commitments says that there is nothing that you can do that would place you outside the reach of love, outside the reach of healing, outside the reach of redemption and reconciliation. There is nothing that you could do. It is the reason behind our first principle, that is the affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It's the principle, the first principle, is usually the one that most people remember, I mean, there are six others, but usually if you ask most anyone who's ever heard of the principles or has come even once to a Unitarian church, usually it's the one somebody will be able to say, oh yes, the affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I think we remember it not just because it's the first principle, but also because it is often the reason that people come to our congregations. Why people decide to call themselves Unitarian Universalists, especially when we hold this principle in contrast to religious traditions that start instead with an affirmation of human sinfulness, human failure, or in contrast to communities that make someone's worth dependent on right behavior or right belief. And even more when it is offered as an antidote to much of the world's tendency today to link someone's ultimate worth with their financial worth, or their race, or their gender, their looks, or their physical abilities. The first principle denies all of this, and for this reason, it feels so good. And also, for these same reasons, the first principle can also feel so wrong. While we are drawn to this radically equalizing notion of humanity, eventually we do all find ourselves in that room, figuratively or literally, with someone who we love who has broken our hearts. And in that moment, the first principle feels not just wrong, but also sometimes ridiculous, even stupid. We think about moments like the one that Naomi Shihab Nye describes at the airport, and we decide those are just fantasies, exceptions to human nature, not the rule. The real world requires not an affirmation of everyone's worth and dignity, but a deep skepticism, distance, judgment. Thick skin. If you trace the course of your life, you can probably still remember the first time you felt this pull between loving and hating someone. The one that comes to mind most clearly for me is my seventh grade teacher. You remember seventh grade, perhaps. My seventh grade teacher, she was in so many ways glorious. She treated my class, she had this way of somehow treating us like we were real people, which when I was thinking about it, I think came down to the fact that she treated us as if we were actors in our own lives, like we were capable and deserving of having an input, a say in the things that ended up impacting us. Which at 12 or 13 is pretty much revolutionary. But then one school day, instead of our glorious teacher greeting us as she usually did, the principal was there. And he told us that our teacher was taking some time away, about 8 weeks, maybe more. They weren't sure if she'd be back, but they hoped so, and that was all they said. We had a substitute. It was all mysterious and confusing and especially painful in that moment because in that moment we felt, my classmates and I, not like people, but like kids. Later that night, while listening to I was sort of listening in on my mom's side of a phone conversation, remember seventh grade? And I learned that my teacher had actually checked herself into a treatment center for addiction. She'd be gone 8 weeks, maybe more. Which, in retrospect, was clearly not an act of betrayal. Likely, she was probably trying to heal betrayal. But at the time, I still felt betrayed. I felt like she'd been lying to us the whole time, that she'd set us up. She'd abandoned us. She did manage to come back to school before the year ended, but things were never the same. I mean, I still loved her, but also in some ways, I hated her too. And putting these two feelings together felt impossible, painful, like mystifying, like I couldn't figure it out. So instead of choosing either love or hate, I chose distance and denial. And I think she did too. These moments happen again and again over the course of our lives, until at a certain point we realize it's not just one or two or three people, but people generally. These individual moments, they scale out across whole systems and societies, across time and culture. In the most general sense, we want to believe what William Ellery Channing said about people, that we have a likeness to God. That if given the freedom, opportunity, and resources, people will choose compassion, fairness, and love. We will choose to offer one another the cookie, and we will receive the cookie in a wonderful act of shared communion among strangers. These ideals are central to our country and our liberal faith. They are the values behind the whole idea of democracy and the free society. And they are the ideas behind our liberal, free religion. That we might put our faith in humanity is a fundamental assertion of humanism, which is a central force still in our faith today. The 1933 Humanist Manifesto affirmed a vision where people, this is a quote from that document, people voluntarily and intelligently cooperate for the common good. But then again, if you go to the Humanist website today to find that manifesto, you'll find at the top a caveat. It says, this document is now considered only historical record. It has been superseded by an update, first in 1973 and then another in 2003. Both updates, they do still, in many ways, locate their faith in humanity, but they include a much more notable ambivalence than that first draft, which makes sense. Not too long after that boldly optimistic vision of 1933 came the start of one of the most brutal periods in human history. As the preface to the 1973 edition says, quote, events since then make that earlier statement seem far too optimistic. Seems like a gigantic understatement. But also, it underscores that this whole emphasis on human goodness in our country's story, in our faith tradition, had to have come from the perspective and experiences primarily of white upper or middle class men. I mean, for example, Native Americans probably did not need to have World War II happen to help them realize how capable humans are of brutality. At the same time as Unitarian ethicist James Luther Adams acknowledged in 1941, while the dominant narrative of post-Enlightenment Western thought has emphasized a positive view of humanity, it's not actually a secret among actual people that we contain within us what Adams called both a will to power and a will to mutuality. It is not actually a secret among actual people that we are capable of both a will to power and a will to mutuality, both across human history and within the human heart, including our own. And yet, despite the fact that it is not a secret, and we have within us still this steady awareness that both of these things exist, it is also true that we continually find ourselves surprised, which is to say, totally unprepared for the moments when this reality presents itself. I mean, the way many of us reacted to the results of the 2016 national election, or the related rise of white nationalism, for example, with shock, or the way we react when someone we know and trust lies to us, acts inappropriately, seeks power instead of mutuality, as if such things were unthinkable or counter to the ways that humans have acted across all of history, as if these instincts are not also present within the human heart. In her new book, After the Good News, Progressive Faith Beyond Optimism, Nancy MacDonald Ladd points out that if you look at the current Unitarian Universalist hymnal, that's the gray one that's around out there, if you look in the back there at the prayers or attend our Sunday services, you'll eventually notice that while we have moments set aside for gratitude or songs of joy or explicit mentions of sorrow and loss, we do not have regular moments where we acknowledge, let alone confess, that we as individual people and as people generally are not always well-intentioned, and that we hurt each other, sometimes even on purpose. Instead, she says, we tend to perform our well-being for each other, for ourselves, which I think is not actually something particular to our liberal religious community, but rather something pretty typical of our age. As in this time in history where on social media we reveal ourselves to each other in ways that appear quite real, but are actually intensely curated and edited. We perform our well-being for each other, the story that we want to share, usually leaving out the moments that where we have failed our friends, our family, and ourselves. This perpetual performance means that over time, we've lost the language, the skills, the resilience to deal with our pain, especially in any sort of communal or collective way. Which doesn't mean that that pain goes away, but instead becomes ensconced in shame, driving us in ways that we are not often conscious of, in ways that we do not even realize. As Richard Rohr says, pain that is not transformed after all will be transmitted. Which I think explains a lot about today and the world we live in. Pain that is not transformed being transmitted. If you go back, however, in our faith tradition at least, this was not always the case. In the 1937 edition of our hymnal, Hymns of the Spirit, you'll find there plenty of options for Unitarians even to acknowledge human shortcomings, including our own version of confession. But by the 1964 edition, these were gone. As MacDonald Ladd says, between 1937 and 1964, Unitarians stopped confessing to anything. We just weren't into it anymore. It wasn't our thing. We got so busy celebrating life every Sunday, we forgot how to authentically examine it. Existential reckoning was, I suppose, too much of a bummer. While I don't disagree about the bummer factor, it's real, I think actually the reason that we have stopped explicitly engaging in human failure in our communal life is actually more connected to that tension that I described in our first principle. That is, the way that it can feel so good and then also so bad. Because I have noticed in these tensions, we tend to talk about the first principle as if it is about us. That is, about humans, about our dignity and worth, as if it is connected to our actions, our words, our living, which means that actually would make it not unconditional, but rather dependent. Luckily, however, the first principle actually has basically nothing to do with us. Let me explain. Like I said, the first principle came out of our universalist tradition, which means, well, to quote the 19th century minister Thomas Starr King's description of our two Unitarian and Universalist traditions, he said, "Universalists believe that God is too good to damn humanity, And Unitarians believe that humanity is too good to be damned. It is an overgeneralization, and it's like a semi-joke that he was making, but the focus he's describing is right. Channing and other Unitarians focused their efforts, their words, on, that was what Sean read from, he read from Channing, on humanity, on humans' capacity for perfectibility. But Universalists, what they were talking about and what they were claiming and interested in was not about humans, but about God. So that when we speak about an affirmation of our inherent worth and dignity, this first principle that comes out of our Universalist tradition, it actually has nothing to do with humanity or human nature or our actions, but rather it is an affirmation that regardless of our actions, nothing that we can do could make us unworthy of love. Nothing. As MacDonald Ladd says, God can work with whatever raw materials he was given to work with, even when those materials are imperfect, slightly dumpy, and occasionally weird like us. Now, if you get tripped up by the theism in all of this, you might try replacing God with just some different language. Try, for example, love. Infinite, ultimate, courageous love. Love can manage to work with whatever raw materials it gets. No matter what we do, love will be there, meeting us not in our performed and curated stories, but in the fullness of our actual stories, in our will to mutuality and our will to power. No matter what, love is there anyway. Which means that when it comes to humanity and humans, we can let in the whole of who we are, trusting that love will be there anyway, so that we might prepare ourselves when humanity reveals itself once again, as it will, to be brutal and cruel. And when it does, our work is to not turn away in distance or denial, but to lean in with practices of real accountability, reconciliation, redemption, truth-telling, and the courage to turn towards rather than from conflict, so that we can be a part of the change that love keeps calling us towards and makes possible. Always and anyway. Amen. And blessed be.